Hey, my name is John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, John.
Tonight's speaker is George, and I've known him for quite some time now. We've both been there for each other's bad and good times, and he's a great friend of mine. And when I think of a good program, I think of George's program, because he's always doing the right thing, calling people, talking to people, and I'm happy to introduce you to him. Here's George.
Good evening, everyone. I'm George, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I'd like to thank the Primary Purpose Group for having me tonight. I appreciate the opportunity to be of service. The point of me being here tonight is to share with you my experience, my strength, my hope, in the hopes that somebody can take something away today that will contribute to their sobriety. The way I was taught to do that is to explain what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So that being said, my sobriety date is January 16th, 2015. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, who I think has a sponsor, right? I have a home group, and I go to one meeting a day. And I pray in the morning, and I pray at night. And it's worked for me so far. So getting to what it was like. I'm not going to spend too much time on war stories. It's more in the solution, but... So I was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I moved here when I was four, and me and my older brother, we had a great childhood. Really, I mean, we had everything we wanted. We had a lot of fun growing up. And looking back on it, I can't really blame anyone else for what happened to me, what I did. Nor do I want to. I don't see anywhere where anyone, forced me to drink like I did, we grew up comfortably, we had a lot of fun, my parents were very loving, if anything, I think they're a little too loving of us, and so we grew up, we talked about this thing, and a lot of people will talk about it, feeling different. I mean, I never felt a part of, I was always like, just kind of a loner, I had friends or people around me that I would socialize with, but I never felt connected to anyone. I mean, I was just in my head, from a kid, and I was a very anxious little boy. I had I used to be scared of spiders, and I would sit in my bed and imagine that spiders were crawling up the sheets and have an anxiety attack, and I was like six or seven. I mean, just scared as can be, my whole life. That's just the way I was. I was fearful. And I remember my dad, to this day, he tells me, I think it was second grade, and I came home and I was bawling, because I was frustrated. I wasn't as good at school as the other kids, and I was just frustrated. School isn't really my thing, I still do it, but I'm not super hype about school, So I come home and I'm crying, and I told my dad, I said, Dad, it's like the other kids are robots, and I'm the only human. I'm the only one that's messing up. Everyone else is just on this path. They all seem perfect. And, to this day, I'm like, man, what a great example of, how the thinking is when you have this disease, I just didn't belong, and I didn't get it. There was something other people had, I felt my whole life, that I didn't have. I was missing something, and I was defective from day one, I always thought, really. And so, going along, and... I went to and took these tests, and they diagnosed me with dyslexia. And I really let that I internalized that a lot. I was like, oh, there, I'm really different. And I actually remember the first instance of my alcoholism. I asked my parents one Christmas for a magic potion to make me good at school. I asked for tablets to, basically, I mean, I didn't know what Adderall was at that age, but basically, I'm asking for drugs, and I'm like, I don't know how old, I was real young, and I remember actually sneaking in the middle of the night one night, and I ate all of them. They gave me, sugar candy, just so I could get the mental, I'm on the magic potion today, and I ate all of them one night, snuck in there, so, but yeah, things went on, and I have an older brother, and... I don't want to go off the impression that I blame him, for my alcoholism or anything like that. He's been a great old brother, and he's actually the reason I'm sober in here today. But we drank it together a lot, you know. And when I was 9 years old, he was 7 years old, he was 16, and he was on a little house party. And, you know, I thought it would be cool to, like, sneak a drink, you know. And he kind of caught me, and he goes, "I'm going to get you so drunk, you're never going to drink again," you know. And so I got, everywhere it was a Skull Handle vodka, you know, real classy, great stuff, high school drink, you know. I don't remember much of it. I was 9 years old, you know. But I remember waking up and I felt like crap. I was like, "You're right, man. I'm not going to drink again. That's terrible," you know. So, you know, 2 weeks later, I introduced my friends to, like, my parents' liquor cabinet. "Look what I found. Yeah, you can drink this stuff. They tell you not to, but we can," you know. And so we started drinking, you know. And, I mean, it was an occasional thing then. You know, I wasn't necessarily an alcoholic at nine, you know. But it progressed, and, you know, and then in high school, this, like, inferiority complex and this fear that just gripped me, it grew worse as I was getting older, and I noticed that trend, you know, and I want to say about, well, see, I quit all sports in, like, 11th grade of high school, which was weird, because sports were really important to me, and I remember being conflicted with that. I was like, you know, I want to quit because, you know, I'm angry at the coach. It's everyone else's fault. You know, they don't see my talent. And, you know, anyway, I quit all sports. And I remember that being one of those, you know, I have several more, but that was one of those turning points where it was like, now I have more time to myself, more time in my head. And that's more time than I need alcohol, you know, because I'm like, you know, I'm getting weird thoughts about the world and about people, and my insecurities and my fear was getting worse. You know, I'm starting to have anxiety attacks at school, and I'm missing class in high school because of anxiety attacks, you know. And so I'm drinking more, and I got a fake ID now, you know. I'm from Texas. I'm George Young, like the drug dealer guy. You know that movie, if anyone's seen Blow, the movie. I got a deep spell just like him. I'm, you know, George from Texas. And I want some, you know, I didn't know what the hell was. You know, I was like, I want some Seagrams, you know. And I'm just drinking random liquor. But I noticed, and, you know, this just kind of shows the progression, you know. I noticed that the handles would last, you know, shorter and shorter amounts of time. And it was like, that was kind of the legwork, I think, for, you know, that was when I put in the hours and the work that kind of pushed me over that line where I became an alcoholic. I remember drinking. I remember I went through a phase where I liked having the spins. I liked it. I would drink till I got, like, dizzy and then pull onto the couch, and I was like, yeah. You know? That's how I knew. I was like, I'm really drunk, you know. And so that went on. You know, it seemed like in high school my life was so structured. You know, like, I had my dad wake me up in the morning. You know, he's, you know, I got my car, I'm driving to school, my classes. Things are very structured, you know. I'm kind of held accountable for my parents, you know. Because I'm living in their house, so, you know, I made it through high school. I had all right grades. I had a great opportunity to go to this really good school, and it's funny how hindsight's 20/20, but at the time, I didn't realize what a great, like, institution that was. It was a really good opportunity, and, you know, unfortunately, I got to chalk it up as a loss, you know, so my alcoholism took that opportunity from me, but, you know, we'll get on to that later, but so I went to this place called Hampton Sydney College, and it's a great institution. There's nothing wrong with it, I now realize. that there was a problem with me, you know. And my anxiety attacks are getting worse. I'm having a lot of fear. And I didn't understand, you know, what the anxiety was from, but I knew that drinking kind of alleviated it. You know, it was like this feeling I would get in my chest. And I don't know, it really, really shook me. And so, but I knew that drinking could alleviate that. So, yeah, I go off to college, and I kind of made it. I mean, I showed up to the dorm room with Wild Turkey 101, a handle, you know, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm like drunk. Like, me and brother are drinking on the ride up. You know, it's an 8-hour drive from here to Virginia, and I'm like, I don't know. The whole time, I just didn't really think twice about it. I was just, my mission was to, like, be, you know, in the party scene of, you know, and anyway, and so I pledged fraternity, and I don't want to get into fraternity life necessarily. They're good guys, really. They're not the reason I drank, you know. I think I did a lot of the influencing, actually. But so it's somewhere along the line. I remember my first attempt to quit drinking resulted in a car accident. I remember waking up, and at this point, I had already begun to realize like this was a serious thing when I would try to stop. I just remember like the morning, I'd begun drinking in the morning so I wouldn't shake because I had gone to class a couple times and had to leave and go to the hospital with a panic attack. I thought I was going to die. And it's kind of a weird, I would show up there, and the doctor knew me at this point. I would show up there and, you know, he'd be like, man, you can't keep coming in here with anxiety and I'm giving you benzos to calm you down. You know, he's like, it's not cool. Like, you know, anyway, so it was becoming to be an issue. You know what I mean? It was, the proof was starting to show up in front of my face, starting to blow up in my face. And, I remember one afternoon, I'm like, I'm going to quit, you know? People are getting on me. When your friends in college are like, dude, you got to cut that out. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a problem when other, 18-year-olds are, like, calling you out and being an alcoholic, like, you know. And so I woke up this one morning, and I just remember feeling weird, man. I don't know. It was just like, I realize now that it was alcohol DTs, but it's like beyond a hangover. It's like you're in this weird zone, man, and, you know, your hands are swollen, you're sweating, and I just remember, like, feeling real weird. I took a test that day, and it was about 9 o'clock at night, and I'm like, I'm a pledge, so I'm taking these guys' food orders, and I'm like, I remember they're telling me what they want on their sandwiches, you know, I want provolone cheese, and I'm writing, like, I want American, you know, I'm writing, like, American. I'm like writing the wrong stuff. And they're like, what's wrong with you, man? I said, you know, like, why can't you get the order right? And I thought that was weird, you know. I was like, I don't know. I'm not really, really feeling weird. Like, I had some serious anxiety going on. Anyway, so I drive to the store. I remember I get the sandwiches. And I'm driving by my buddy's house. I remember looking at his house. And everything went black. And I remember waking up and, like, the inside of the car is, like, smashed up real bad. And I remember seeing my new radio was smashed. I remember thinking, damn, that thing was brand new. That was really nice. I liked that. Like, I can't believe I already broke that. And then, but then I hear, like, the jaws of life, and they're cutting the door off. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, still in, like, it's the haze, you know. And I'm like, what? You know, I don't really know what's going on here. This guy goes, you just been involved in a car accident. We're going to pull you out. And I was like, no, I haven't, but whatever. Like, I felt like a dream. It really felt like just weird in a dream. So if he starts pulling me out, and he's like, we're gonna pull your right leg out now, you know? And I'm like, yeah, go ahead, do it. And I didn't feel anything at this point. And so he pulls my leg out, and I feel this dead weight hanging off. And I look down, and I got a bone sticking through my corduroys. You know, I had shattered my right leg. And then I had a panic attack, you know, and they took me to the hospital. And, you know, this is one of the weirdest things. I felt this sense of relief that I had, like, wrecked. You know, I was failing out of some classes at that point. I just felt a lot of pressure. I was, like, really, really not enjoying my life at that point. I mean, I could not handle this anxiety and this fear that gripped me every morning. You know, I remember going to bed, and I was scared to wake up because I knew that I was just going to have alcohol withdrawals. I was going to be shaking. I was going to be vomiting. I was going to have an anxiety attack. That was every morning. And I really, honestly, I felt relieved. I mean, they give you some meds at the hospital to make you feel all right. But I really was, like, I was relieved. I was like, man, I get to go home now and just recollect. You know, I almost failed out this semester. I used to take a medical with, you know, leave. And I just remember how weird that was. You know, my friends are visiting me, and they're like, man, like, you know, they expect me to be upset, you know, and I'm like, nah, man, it's all good, you know, going back home, and I'll be back next semester, it's cool, you know, my leg's shattered, you know, it just, you know, was not in touch with reality, really, at that point, and so I go home, and then what the weird thing was, you know, I thought school was kind of the problem, and, like, school made me anxious, so I drank a lot, and, you know, I got this break now, I'm going to be home, and things will be better. But I remember still having this empty feeling inside. I got home, you know, and I'm sitting around, and my anxiety got worse. I had more fear about life and about, I don't know, it did not help. and like I thought that it would. And my drinking escalated. That was another one of those turning points where, you know, it made sense to drink more, and I needed more alcohol. And I sat around and drank, and, you know, I would put on, like, my brave face for, you know, my parents in the daytime. I didn't want them to worry, you know. And I, like, recovery's going good, you know, took a step today. And but then at night I would get drunk and, like, listen to sad music and cry, you know. And I really felt like something was missing in my life, and I really started to realize, like, now there's, you know, there's evidence that, like, my drinking has caused this accident. And I didn't even, so the reason, and for a while we thought, well, he must have fallen asleep at the wheel. And I remember as soon as the, you know, we were talking about what could have happened, I was like, there's no way I fell asleep. I was feeling weird. I mean, I was jittery. I was weird that day, and I did not fall asleep. And what we figured out later on, you know, in consulting with my doctor, I actually had a seizure at the wheel, and that's why I crashed. And I crashed into a tree and had the cruise control on, and I was like 45. I really was lucky to walk away from that with only a broken leg, you know. I got to believe someone was looking out for me that day. But so I get home, and I'm doing this rehab thing. I'm really pretty miserable. All right. The vacation that I had planned in my head, you know, was not necessarily a vacation. It was a long, painful journey to get my leg properly, you know, so I could use it again. Thankfully, I got a good surgeon, and he did a great job, and I was really, really lucky to really keep my leg, and it functions pretty well now. But I got 19 bolts, and I got two plates in my right leg, and every time I go to the airport, it's kind of funny to watch them. You know, they do that body scan now, and I always look at the people because they're always like they don't see it coming. You know, I don't necessarily limp up or anything, and they're like, you know, like, whoa, there's, you know, bionic leg down there. So I came back, and, you know, again, like, I was a pretty willful person, you know. Like, I got myself back in school, went to class wearing a boot and in extreme amounts of pain. You know, but I walked to class every day, and I that would be the best grades of my college career that semester. You know, and I had come back from that, and, you know, I mean, it's an example of, like, I was a pretty willful person, you know, but I could not stop drinking. That wasn't something I remember just knowing, you know, and when the people around you know, it's really pitiful, you know, like, people know that you're the one that's out of control. You're the one that's got a problem, you know. And it's no fun, man. But so I just continued. I just kept trucking along. And, you know, went to school for a while. I just kept doing it. My drinking escalated. And so then a second time that I'm trying to quit drinking on my own, again, it was a similar feeling as when I had the car accident. I remember I woke up this morning. Exams were in a week. And I was like, I'm going to quit for exams. I'm going to quit drinking. You know, I need to cut this out. You know, I need to get my stuff together. And so I remember walking around. I feel weird all day. I got this weird, just these withdrawals are, man, it's, I don't know. It's really bad. It's bad. And people notice. But so I'm sitting on the couch with my buddies. And, you know, I'm just sitting there, like, staring at the wall, like, you know, I'm not engaging in conversation. I'm just, like, holding on to the couch, like, trying to act normal. And so I get up. I'm like, I gotta go type this paper, you know, and I get up. And I blacked out. I didn't remember what happened. But, and I come to, and my buddy's, like, pushing me on the couch, you know. And I was like, what, get off me. What's going on, you know. And they're like, you just had a seizure for about 2 minutes in front of us. And I was like, damn, you know, now people know, you know, I just had a seizure in front of like 8 people, you know, and I mean, I was embarrassed. I was really kind of scared. I was like, man, this is getting real, you know, because in my mind, I'm like different, you know, I can take the heat. I can drink like other people can't, and I would still go to class, you know. I was prideful with that. I thought, like, I can do this, you know, I can pull this off. I came back from that accident, you know. I'm making good grades. I can do it. I don't really have a problem because it's me, you know. I can handle it. And now it's like my body is reacting, you know what I mean? And so I go to the hospital after that. And they run some diagnosis, and like, I have these stomach problems, you know, and I figure, I sort of tell them everything there, because I'm like, I'm scared at this point. I'm like, I just had a seizure, you know, and from this alcohol withdrawals. And I had alcoholic gastritis, and I had a hemorrhage in my stomach, because I would drink every morning, and would just, you know, Russian standard vodka, that was the way to go. You know, I started my morning with that, and I had these stomach issues, you know, my liver enzymes were all messed up, and but so, you know, they gave me a sedative, it kind of, you know, calmed me down, and I went back to school later that day, and I continued, I took exams, I stayed sober for a week, and I remember calling my dad, and I was like, Dad, like, you know, I quit drinking for a week, you know, and I feel great. Like, I was like proud of that. 7 days not drinking was like pretty good for me, like, you know, and I got through my test. And I remember I felt really good about that. But so then I came home for the holidays, and so I remember I was like, my girlfriend at the time, I was telling her how I'm like sober now, you know. But I need a few of those, you know, anxiety pills you have. I'm having a rough day. But I'm sober now, you know? Like, can you believe it? Like, I quit, you know, of all people. I quit drinking. Like, and so one thing led to another, and I you know, I cracked. I mean, I got, like, probably 10 days sober, and I started drinking again. And, you know, my brother had already gotten sober at this point. And I remember one night I had just been drinking for a while, and for some reason I opened up to my parents. I told them about it, that I was struggling with this issue, you know. And so my mom called my brother, and he took me to a meeting. And you know, this is it, man. I'm done drinking. You know, I was so, if I ever go to AA meeting, I'm done. Then, you know, that's the final line, you know. So I went to that meeting, and I probably didn't drink for 2 days, and, you know, and I was like, well, I probably overreacted, it'll be all right. And so I'm in the throes of this bender, and I guess my girlfriend at the time had bought us tickets to the Ole Miss game, and, you know, just like, she called me in the morning, she's like, hey, you ready? And I'm like, yeah, I'm ready for that thing that I know what you're talking about. I'll be there. Let's go do that thing that we were talking about doing, that I remember talking to you about we're going to do. And so she picks me up, and I'm like, you know, I'm having some, it's in the morning, and I haven't had my drinks yet. And I think it's like 11 in the morning. And so I stopped by, I said, hey, let's make a stop. You know, I stopped by this liquor store, and I remember her saying, like, you know, it wasn't like, really, you're drinking again? You know, it wasn't like a confrontational. It was an honest, like, is that a good idea? Like, but, you know, the sincerity of that, like, is that a good idea? Like, I don't know. You know, like, not, there's no judgment in that. It was like I think she was actually scared, you know, and with, rightfully so. But I remember that being a moment, I was like, you know, this is not a good idea. So I went, and I got a thing of Russian Standard, and I drank it, and I don't remember a whole lot from that day. I remember Ole Miss got their behinds whooped, and I got in a fender bender in her car on the way home. Anyway, so then I got home. Again, I don't remember a whole lot. I think I broke some furniture in my mother's house, and just kind of a cry for help. You know? I didn't want to go in there and, like, tell her I need help. I'd rather her come in here like, what's the matter, you know? And I'm like, just broke this table, and I'm, you know, raging alcoholic. I need help, you know? Didn't have the nerve to, like, walk in there and, I don't know, unload, you know? I had to make a ruckus, so. And again, so she calls my brother again. And, you know, it was a great demonstration by my brother of, you know, attraction, not promotion. You know, he never stuffed anything down my throat. He never was like, hey, you should get sober, you know, because I know how you drink, because we drank a lot together, you know. It was just, he did his thing, and he waited for me to get ready, you know, until I was ready to admit I had a problem. And so he takes me over to Peachford, the detox unit, because, you know, I've been known to have seizures for my alcohol DTs. So we go over to Peachford, and for some reason they sent me to the hospital. I guess it's protocol, I don't know. But so I had a 0.36, and I was, last thing I remember, I was arguing with the security guard at the hospital about them not returning my tennis shoes, because when I had surgery about my car wreck, they didn't return my tennis shoes. And I like those shoes, man. And the security guard's like, what do you want? You know, I'm not in charge of the shoes, man. Like, just calm down so we can get you out of here. So then they, you know, I woke up in Peachford the next day. And I guess, you know, that's when I started my journey. I didn't know it yet. I was still, like, I was kind of thinking I would do that detox thing. And then, I don't know, I just thought it would work out. I didn't really worry. I didn't think a whole lot about it. And so I went through detox. It was like the 9 longest days of my life, you know. I mean, thank God for what they do, you know, Peachford. Helped me a lot, but there's some rough characters in there. We had some funny stories about that. But so anyway, I get through detox, and I'm like at this point feeling better. You know, physically I feel good, and I was gonna go back to school and do school sober in Virginia. You know, the place where everything kind of happened. And you know, luckily my parents sat me down and just really, really pleaded with me, like, you know, just, you know, my brother knows this guy who owns a men's treatment center, and, like, you know, will you just go try it out, you know? And I don't know, for some reason, I don't know why, I was just, like, I just knew that going back to school wasn't a good idea. And I was so crazy at the time, I don't know how them talking to me, I guess it was kind of just the way they approached it was very sincere, and, like, you know, I could see the concern in their eyes when they're talking to me. So I agreed to go, and I went to this place called Purple, and it's a great men's treatment center. It's very straightforward, straight up recovery, you know. And that was when I started my, you know, my journey to here. And so I get there, actually the day I get out of detox, before I got there, I went to a Triangle meeting, and this guy Mark Denninger was telling a story. He's got like 26 years, but I remember that was the first story I ever heard. I didn't really know much about, you know, AA, really. But his story made so much sense to me, you know. I mean, he drank like I did, you know, and like he went and did a lot of the same things I did. And he talked about a lot of stuff, you know. He talked about God, and he talked about, you know, spirituality and loving people, and none of that made any sense to me, you know. Like, God is stupid, I hate people, and spirituality, what are you, a hippie, you know? I didn't want to hear it. But this guy, you know, there was a glow about him, you know. So I asked him kind of, you know, I said, will you sponsor me? And he didn't have room to sponsor me, but he had a sponsee who could sponsor me. And so, you know, we went to work, and I believe I did my first 12 steps in like 60 days. Which was good for me, because I had a lot of anxiety and stuff when I was especially the first few months. And I just remember, I don't know, I just needed something to do, you know. We got in the literature, we got in the book, and we worked the steps. And so, you know, my experience with the steps is that, you know, I come in with the first step, and I'm like, powerless over alcohol, I got that, you know. I understood that my willpower wasn't going to beat this thing, because I really, really was I was a pretty willful person, and I couldn't make myself stop for any amount of real time, you know. And when if physically it had me beat, you know, I had seizures, I had stomach issues, I had a liver enzyme issue, you know, the pigment in my eyes were all messed up, I looked like crap, and I wasn't sleeping right. So I, you know, it, like, physically I could tell it had me beat, you know. So I could get down with that. And my life's unmanageable. That took me a little bit to understand, because I thought that if I'm in school and I'm making grades, I'm not homeless, you know, I'm a pretty active person, that I'm manageable, you know, because on paper I look good or whatever. But I didn't understand that, like, you know, having panic attacks and being fearful every day and waking up shaking and vomiting isn't manageable. You know, that's no way to live. It really isn't. And hating, like, I just remember the apathy I had for the common person was so bad. Like, I could not get along with people. I really couldn't. And it's, you know, it's still a thing I have to work on to, like, connect with people and love them to get that experience. But I just remember, like, you know, and it was hard for me to get that, you know, the things that really matter, not the car, not the money, not the clothes that you wear, not the, you know, whatever. Fill in the blank. But to understand that that stuff isn't what defines me as a person. Like, it doesn't, it's not what's important. And it's the only thing I understood to measure success with, you know? And so it took me a little bit to get that, to understand that I didn't really have my bases covered. I wasn't really taking care of myself, you know, mentally, spiritually. But eventually I got that. But at first, you know, I just had to understand I was whooped. I needed help. I'll do anything. I'll do what it takes, you know? So then we get to step two. Can't believe the power greater than ourselves to restore sanity. I got that I was a little insane, you know. I felt insane. You know, I remember I would do a lot of research online on Wikipedia about mental disorders. And, you know, when I was having, like, alcohol DTs, and I'd be freaking out, like, what's happening, you know. I think, am I psychotic? Am I going to snap? You know, I was really scared. Anyway, I was insane. A higher power, that was, you know... I had a religious faith growing up, and I remember that doing a lot of good for me when I was younger. But as I grew, I would call myself Christian just because of the stigma that would have. I thought you would think I was a good person if I say I'm a Christian man. You know, I didn't really believe that Jesus Christ died for our sins. You know, I was a fraud, and I hung on to that. But I knew I had to get real with this. I had to find a higher power. I had to find something that would, you know, exponentially change my view on life. And, you know, faking that I believed in this Jesus Christ the way that I said I did, you know, I was being a fraud. Now, that works for a lot of people, and there's nothing wrong with religion. I'm not here to bash religion. That's not, I myself was using it fraudulently, you know, and I had to get real with what a higher power meant to me. And at first, what that meant was really just the group. And I believed that if I did what my sponsor did, I would get the results he got, because he drank like me. And it made sense. I was like, I'll do what you do to get what you got, you know? And I believed that those steps, there was something that about him that if I did them the way that my sponsor did them, that I would get the results he got. And that was how I got my start. I got my foot in the door, you know, spiritually with that. And then step three, to turn my will over, you know, at first, the first go around, that just meant I'm going to finish steps. I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to go to a meeting a day, call you every day. I'm going to do my steps. And that was turning my will over enough, just to trust the process, you know, to turn my will over to, like, my will is going to go away from what I feel like doing today, which was, at the time, getting drunk. You know, the first 3 months, man, I wanted to get drunk almost every day. It was tough. And I'm going to turn my will from that to working on these steps, working with others, trying to be of service, trying to understand what this thing's about, you know, and I'm going to follow these steps. And that was my first, you know, that was what the third step meant to me at a month sober, you know. I was just going to do this program. And I was going to trust the program, which was hard to do at times. And a lot of times I didn't think it was working. I thought I was missing something. And, there was a lot of doubt that I had to arrest with prayer and, you know, calling my sponsor and talking to people about that. And then the fourth step, I didn't really struggle with. I didn't feel that my story was all that crazy. I don't know. I mean, I was in a men's treatment center, so, you know, we would sit around and trade war stories because, you know, I'm the most craziest guy you ever knew. You know what I mean? Like, we're guys, so we're, you know, being stupid and competitive about our war stories. So I knew my story wasn't that crazy, you know. So I was pretty willing to, like, write out all this stuff, you know. It was an awkward thing, though, to sit down with another man and tell him all of your, you know, your little things that go on in your head and all the things you resent and why you resent them, you know. It's a little awkward, and it's awkward to talk about your sex conduct. But, you know, you got to think that what you put into it. And the way I've really found that uncomfortability breeds spiritual growth. You know, it gets uncomfortable in that fifth step, but you do it and you get more out of it. You know, the more uncomfortable you get, the more deep you get with that fifth step, the more you'll get out of it. And I've done three fifth steps, and each time I got a little deeper because my head's a little clearer, and I've done a little more self-reflection, and I can get a little more honest with it, you know, because honesty now today isn't what it was when I had a month sober. You know, it's changed a little bit. And so I'm able to get a little deeper now. But the more uncomfortable it gets, the more growth I get out of it. So, and then six and seven. Six is I've got to come to terms with what these character defects are that are cutting me off from God and cutting me off from my fellows. I got to determine what they are. Well, we do that in our fifth step. But then I have to come to terms with them, and I just have to be willing to let God remove them. Which can be hard, you know. I like to think I'm right a lot. I would argue about things I knew I was wrong about and lie about the evidence of why I'm right, and it drove people insane, you know. I was just a hard-headed person, and I had a lot of internal struggle with this hatred I have for people, you know. And I had to be willing to have that stuff removed, because it cut me off from everyone else and it cut me off from God. And then in 7, we humbly ask Him to do so. I ask Him to remove that stuff. And, you know, I still do my 3rd and 7th step prayer every morning. Still to this day. I do them in a row, and then I just go off the top of my head. But those prayers are huge. They're really important. The stuff they say is like, you know, I mean, you've got to be willing to give myself over to my higher power, right? Like, I'm going to be, this isn't about me anymore, right? I gave that run. I gave that shot where I was like about me. I was doing it for me. I was going to go make things happen. And my ego was, you know, me controlling my life. And I had to turn that over to realize that I'm not in control. It's a delusion in my head that I'm in control of everyone around me and of everything going on. And I have to understand that there's a higher power that's in control of that today. And that brings me a lot of peace and serenity. And then in 7th step prayer, I got to ask God to remove this junk that I've built up in my head, you know, that cuts me. It makes it not so that I can't see God, you know, because when I was drinking and when I was going through the stuff I had to go through, you know, I firmly believe that God was there the whole time. You know, God is the good and bad. He's everything or he's nothing. So God was those bad things that happened to me. You know, they're only bad because I say they're bad. You know, that wreck is bad because I didn't like it, you know. But, like, I had to go through that stuff to get, it's like a love tap from God, you know. It's pushing me in a direction. And I couldn't see it at the time. I couldn't see that God was there. I just, my eyes were not open to it. And I can see today how I was being guided the whole time into the way of life, you know. And that's why that bad stuff had to happen. Anyway, so and then 8 and 9, you know, we go out and make these amends. Not all of mine were great, you know. Some of them, this with my grandfather on my dad's side, he was a little bit, he's like an old Navy guy, and he doesn't really do the feely stuff, you know. And he's just like, what, you know, he didn't really understand the first time. But then I went and saw them in person and I explained a little more what I'm doing, and my grandparents were a lot more open to it. And so that took, you know, and that's still a thing. That's still a living amends to them, you know. I still got to show up. And I have a living amends out with my family, you know. And I show up, and I'm a son, and I'm a brother, you know. And I'm there, and I do, you know. It's like suiting up and showing up. It's nothing. I don't got to be anything that I'm not. Does that make sense? I don't have to lie, cheat, and steal to get what I want or to be what I think I should be. I just got to be me, and I just got to show up. And the best I can do is the best I can do, you know. And I realize that today. I don't push it like, you know, I've got to make a certain GPA, or I've got to have a certain amount of money when I grow up, or I need this certain job, because it's not about that, you know. That's not the game today, you know. The game is just being the best person I can be by being myself, you know. I'm not lying, I'm not stealing, I'm not cheating to get what I, to manipulate the things the way I think they should go. So, anyway, I go out and make those amends. They're awkward, they're hard to do, but I do them and I get a lot out of them, you know. That's where the promises come in. I start having a spiritual experience. That's really where I start feeling better about coming to terms with my past. I start feeling the growth. I start feeling better. And then 10, 11, 12, you can just rip together. But so the 10th step is where basically, you know, I took that inventory because I had 21 years of crap built up, you know. And in my 10th step now, I take my inventory each night about what happened that day, you know, the junk that built up that day. It's like, oh, I got to clear the system, you know, and then I got to pray about it. So I go over those questions every night. And then, you know, prayer, meditation, and 11 is I've got to get some type of contact. I need emotional sobriety. And this is where, so I can be physically sober, but I can be emotionally intoxicated. And what that looks like is anger, fear, jealousy, you know, depression. And those things, you know, in the book it doesn't say if those things crop up. It says when they crop up, you know, we pray immediately. We do a spot check, you know. And the goal is to be able to tell when that stuff's happening so I can pray to God immediately. I can ask him to remove it at once, and I can get on with my day being useful, not being in that anger, you know. And I don't always do that. I'm not, you know, the czar of, hey, you're being perfect. You know, I'm not perfect. I live, still have some fear, you know, and I have to pray about that stuff. But, you know, and meditation brings me a lot of ease. You know, it helps with my anxiety. It helps me sleep at night. You know, that's kind of a practice that waxes and wanes. Sometimes I'm feeling it and I'm into it, you know. And other times it's like I'm doing a little 10-minute thing, you know. But it, you know, it helps a lot. It's good. And 12 is where, like, I stay sober today. I help others, you know. I come here, I share my story, you know, I talk to a sponsee, I walk him through the steps, I'm there for him. You know, I help with the chairs of my meeting, you know. And it's just trying to live a useful life, you know. Where things were about me, you know, it's about getting out of me today. And that, you know, that 12 step is like not a thing. You know, I don't have to have X amount of time to like start helping someone else. You know, the time to do that is now. If you have a day sober, go help the guy who has an hour sober so he can get his first day, so you can get your second day. You know, get to work with other people. It helps me. It's been my experience that when I work with other people, I get out of my, I don't know, my head, man. It really helps. That's how I do it. That's what keeps me sober today. Yeah, and I'm gonna end on a piece that is my favorite part of any of the literature in AA. And yes, the 12 and 12. Oh, it's not the big book, blah blah. My old sponsor used to bash kind of the 12 and 12. But this kind of explains like what my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what it's about for me. These last two pages of step 12 and 12 and 12. It really sums up my understanding of what's important in my life today. So we start on page 124. But today, in well-matured AAs, these distorted drives have been restored to something like their true purpose and direction. We no longer strive to dominate or rule those about us in order to gain self-importance. We no longer seek fame and honor in order to be praised. When by devoted service to family, friends, business, or community, we attract widespread affection and are sometimes singled out for the posts of greater responsibility and trust. We try to be humbly grateful and exert ourselves the more in the spirit of love and service. True leadership, we find, depends upon able example and not upon vain displays of power or glory. Still more wonderful is the feeling that we do not have to be specially distinguished among our fellows in order to be useful and profoundly happy. Not many of us can be leaders of prominence, nor do we wish to be. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help, the knowledge that at home or in the world outside, we are partners in a common effort. The well-understood fact that in God's sight, all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs and round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. True ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And what that tells me is that, you know, it outlines the things that I need to focus on, things that are important. Right, a spiritual life, a connection with a higher power, a connection with other people. You know, this other stuff that like I was so focused on, it's kind of a game, man. You know, this the money, the job, the car, the house, and the things that I put. You know, before I understood anything about spirituality, you know, when I was too smart for it, you know, that stuff that drove me insane and filled me with fear that I wouldn't get those things. You know, and it turns out they don't matter. You know, I get the spiritual nourishment that I need to live here. And that's why I keep coming back. So thank you for having me.